Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour and joined by an old friend, Mark Christensen. How are you, Mark?
Great, Mike. Nice to speak with you.
What are you up to tonight? At the moment?
I'm finishing up the new edition of my visual effects compositing and After Effects book.
Wow.
Yeah.
So your other book is you, how many books do you have?
This is the fifth version of fifth edition, I should say.
It's the edition, okay. Because it's so successful.
Yeah, I mean, each one is kind of, I put a lot into these. You know, I suppose I could put less into them, but I end up putting a lot into them. So, yep.
Excellent. And also join online a new co-host, who's someone we hope to have a regular on the show, Todd from FX Rant. Todd, how do I say you successfully your surname so that I don't screw it up? I'm terrible with names. I apologize in advance.
No, it's okay. Todd Vaziri.
Vaziri. So, Todd, yeah. I've known your work from stuff that you've published online and stuff, and I was very keen to get you on the show. Though you and I actually...
No, wait, you read it and then you still wanted to get me on? I don't understand.
Absolutely. And and yet, I feel like I know you. We don't really know each other that well, but I'm so glad you're joining us on the show. I look forward to getting your insights.
So I can't wait to let you down. No, we'll do what we can. We have a great topic tonight.
So, Todd, give everyone just a little bit of a background on where you're at and what you do.
Oh, I'm currently at Industrial Light and Magic. I'm a compositor, sequence supervisor, and I'm having a lot of fun. I'm working on our first animated film right now called Rango.
And you've done some amazing stuff online on your blog or website, including the VFX predictor.
The predictor. You mean like all those countless hours of obsessive research that we did on Academy Award winners and all
yeah,
that?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm really going to talk about it more at the end of the show, but you should definitely check out VFX Rant at blogspot.com, but we'll do that at the end. So this week we're going to talk about a film that barely qualifies actually as an effects film in one metric, but in another I completely embrace as one of my all-time favorite effects films. And the mystery to how that is so, Mark, do you want to explain the film we're talking about and why I would say that?
All right. We're talking about Back to the Future, which I agree. If I think of the 80s, Back to the Future is right up there among memorable, we can't say effects-driven films, because even for the standards of the time, this was a pretty small effects film, almost kind of a side job, I think, for ILM at the time. Only maybe less than 36 shots in this thing.
It's extraordinary. I actually heard someone from ILM talking once at a conference, and they explained to me how ILM got involved, and I don't know how accurate this is. If anyone knows differently, correct me. But the story I was told was that, firstly, it was a Spielberg film in the sense that he was a producer of it, and so ILM had such a good working relationship with Spielberg, they were really happy to help out. The second reason was that the initial script had the atomic blast as the primary power source from Getting Back from the 50s, and so ILM was really keen to do the sequence because what would happen is they would get to recreate those classic buildings being blown apart, atomic blast stuff that we've seen from the real military films, and they would get to recreate that. And that sounded like a lot of fun to a pre-digital model shop biased ILM bunch of gods. And they said, oh, that sounds great. And of course, then the script changed from being a refrigerator that was in an atomic bomb testing ground to being a DeLorean with lightning bolts. Have you heard any different to that anecdote, Todd?
No, that sounds about right. And in addition, it was kind of a package deal with the Amblin films. I think they were just finishing. The deal was that they would work on Goonies, and then as soon as Goonies was done, which also was an Amblin film, if I'm not mistaken, the crew would kind of roll. The post crew would roll right over into Back to the Future.
Yeah, absolutely. And so let's, when we can discuss it in many things, so let's discuss it just as a film first, as we like to do, and then we'll come back and discuss. And one of the interesting things I want to discuss later in the show with you guys is actually perhaps not what would immediately come to mind, which is the digital or rather analog aging of the characters that was done. Not the most obvious thing perhaps, but I think it's an interesting area to discuss. But before we do that, just let's discuss it in terms of a sort of a film. We're talking about literally the mid 80s here. This is the height of wearing jeans with suspenders around your knees and checked shirts with vests that look like life preservers. So, Todd, starting with you, what point were you at in your life when you saw this, and did you enjoy it at the time?
Oh boy, this movie meant a lot to me. I remember very vividly sitting in the theater going, well, like, this is such an incredible roller coaster, and like, this is probably the movie that caused me to want to go and do filmmaking. I mean, I just wanted to know, like, what on earth, why is this movie affecting me so much? I remember thinking about it for so long, and it got me all interested in science fiction and time travel and all these things. And, you know, this is really the picture that started me down a path of going into filmmaking. So, yeah, it means a lot to me.
What about you, Mark?
Yeah, like I said, this feels like a big film. It's a lot of fun. I rewatched it with my kids, who are really young. And I think at the time, you know, the subject matter apparently was too racy for Disney to produce this film. Yet the handling of that in this, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the center of the film is this kind of edible desire of this kid's mother for him. And then, you know, the climax of the film, she's nearly raped. And yet, my God, there's almost no dark side to this movie.
Yeah, there's like no, you know, cruelty in it. Marty is like he could be like on a, this is a Family Channel, like, great kid. All he wants to do is trying to get his family back together and just make things right. There's nothing mean about it at all. I mean, it's as family friendly as you could get, probably, except
yeah,
for this
and
stuff.
If they had stuck with Eric Stoltz as the lead, I wonder if that would have been different.
I really like Eric Stoltz, even when he's sticking needles into John Travolta's heart. And I feel sorry for him that he wasn't included on this film. I really do think he's a good actor. But yeah, it's hard to imagine anyone else but Michael J. Fox in that role. And also, it was not a big stretch from the character he was playing on Family Ties, which I must admit, when I was a kid, I thought Family Ties was a great show, hysterically funny. I thought Alex P. Keating was actually pretty cool, and I thought this was a great movie. But let me ask you something else. I'm going to pick up on something I think you first picked on, Mark, which is this idea of it being a clean film. I was doing some research for FX PhD and a talk a class I'm giving there, and I'm going to plug a book here called The Hollywood Economist, and in it pointed out that let me challenge you guys. Think of any film in the last 5 years of any consequence from the studios that had sex and nudity in it. Come on, just any film.
Jeez.
Any film, come on. Any film that's like a Hollywood studio film.
You know, the Hollywood studios, they R-rated films, you know, that just means more blood and more violence to them. It's not about like adult relationships and sex and things like that. So
I
can't think of any.
There is none. I challenged the guys in the office for it. And so they were all like, you know, willing to take my bet. And so they started yelling out things, which I thought was really funny, like New Moon. They said, there must be sex in New Moon, right? It's all about like teen sex and stuff. Now, I haven't seen that film, and I generally try and steer clear of that entire thing. But I looked up the ratings from MPAA for that. And I'd like to read you the sex in this incredibly erotic film about the lust that is, you know, obviously so strong that it's driven this film to be one of the great all-time kind of modern love stories of, and the sex rating that this thing got consisted basically of I think one guy and girl who happened to be in bed for a bit, and somebody pointing at her own breasts and putting the thumbs up and indicating that either her or somebody else's breasts were quite good. That's it. Oh, and there's one line in there about someone stuffing their Speedos. That's the level of sex and nudity in a, you know, steamy teenage, you know, whatever film aimed at that demographic today. We have reached a point in the industry that there just is no sex because they can't sell it to Walmart, and Walmart sells DVDs, and you don't make films without it. So I don't know where this started back with Back to the Future, but I agree with you. It's an incredibly sanitized, gorgeous, wonderful, healthy, Hallmarky channel piece of teenage fun.
Yeah, it has a real sense of innocence about it, which it does come from the Porky's era. So I think maybe that's more what Disney read into the script. I don't know.
I guess.
Well, Mark, what did your kids enjoy the film? Were they into it?
They really did.
Yeah?
My daughter in particular really was just fascinated by this thing with, you know, the mother having a crush on her son. And but they were tripping out on the whole time travel part of the story for, I think they missed their bedtime by easily an hour, just coming up with more and more questions about it. And that's no small thing, because we can always drive holes the size of a truck through any time travel movie, and this one really is no exception. And yet, it does really actually raise interesting questions, as opposed to just kind of, oh God, I couldn't stand it when that happened kind of questions.
Well, it's a pretty simple, quiet film, and yet it is extremely fast paced. So I always wonder if today's like kids would be able to handle a film that is like this. And it's really great to hear that they actually can.
It's actually really slow in the first act, this film. In fact, it's even for the time, I think maybe it was, but I think some of these films that felt like they were so fast-paced at the time, like Indiana Jones and this one, by today's standards, I'm not so sure.
Yeah,
I think it was... My kids loved it. They thought it was great fun. And I think that Doc Brown's character is fairly broad in his comic kind of deliveries. I think there's also something, and I don't want to sound condescending, but I mean, Michael J. Fox has that look about him that he's quite range, he has sort of a broad appeal in his range of age appeal. Like, it's not that he looks so old that, you know, he feels like he's an adult, but not so young that he feels like. So I think he appeals to a broad group of people, and I think kids can kind of identify with him a bit. I don't know how old he was meant to be in this film, but, you know, he doesn't feel like he's an old teen. And so he's quite accessible, I think. He's and therefore, you know, I think he drives the warmth of the film. So let's get to the visual effects for a second, and we'll start with the really obvious stuff, which is the time travel. It's a not insignificant problem to be presented with. Okay, so now we have to have something go through time. I mean, that's the sort of the portal problem of many films. This one was helped by the fact that it was at least a moving car, so that, you know, invited some kind of you know, transition where it's in the present on the right of frame and it's not in the present on the left of frame. How do you think they handled, Mark, the time travel? Did it have an energy that was appropriate?
Oh, it's iconic. The combination of the smoldering tire tracks and the fantastic Emperor's lightning glancing off the front of the vehicle, I mean, I think it was on the poster. It worked. It had, I mean, I think the brief was probably pretty tough, you know, like I think it needed to go up to the Star Wars level, but then take that to this naturalistic setting. In fact, I think a lot of the big effects from this film were kind of like effects that had been mastered in Star Wars that were now taken over to present day life.
I understand from a particularly short but good article in Cinefix, I think we're in number 24, that they were looking at a lightning kind of effect, but because of Terminator, which had just come out, they didn't want to have the kind of sparks thing, so they went for more the flames thing. And I think you're right. I think that the tire treads without the car there as the blazing, flaming, I'm not quite sure where that fire was coming from effect, worked so well. It said, there went the car, it's not there anymore, and it was dramatic, and it gave it a real kind of visual eye candy.
Yeah, personally, yeah, the fire trails for me is what helped sell the effect almost more than the opticals. I mean, it's something that was so iconic. It's like, where did the car go? There's this little remnant of the car, and having all of that done by the physical effects guys, and having the actors actually interact with it and some, you know, just some fantastic shots really helped sell it and push the imagination, like, what, you know, really to the next level. And those fire trails were like probably the hardest physical effect they had to do for the entire show, because apparently it was like really, really hard to control to get it to ignite at the right speed. I mean, it's supposed to be, you know, indicating a car that was just going 88 miles an hour. Well, to get fire to ignite at 88 miles an hour was really impossible. They had to undercrank and do all this stuff. But I think the opticals as well as the physical effects, they work together to help sell the effect.
I think we should point out that the post-production schedule for this film was absurd even by today's standards. Does anyone want to comment on that? Did you know what that you got the numbers there, Mark? Or?
Well, essentially, they did a preview after finishing principal photography a few weeks. You know, they got a rough cut together in something like June. And they decided that they wanted to get the film open by July 4th based on how nuts the test audience in San Jose went for it, which meant that it was in theaters 9.5 weeks after it finished shooting. And that was not only a problem for ILM, sound editing at the time was pretty painstaking. And so they had to double up those guys and work them 24-hour shifts just to get that part of the film done.
I mean, that is...
And that's just crazy. 9.5 weeks. Jeez.
I mean, you'd almost... I almost jumped in there to just clarify. That wasn't July the following year. That was like July. Yeah. I mean,
when you consider that post-schedule along with all of the problems they had getting the movie off the ground with the whole Eric Stoltz thing and then having to shut down production and recast and then get Michael J. Fox on that extremely limited schedule that he was doing to actually shoot the film because he was shooting days on Family Ties and then nights on Back to the Future and weekends on Back to the Future. I mean, there's no reason why this movie should have been, you know, such a success and to almost be like this perfect film.
I do think that looking back at the visual effects work now, there is some stuff that holds up better than others. I think for whatever reason, the classic three-panel shot of the Doc and Marty on blue screen and blue floor comped over the flames as it went through their legs. That was widely used in sort of general press. It was widely used in visual effects reference stuff. Never thought it was a particularly good comp myself.
It's not that great. I was actually nervous to say that, you know, a couple of the opticals in the film are just not that great. Even when you look at the quality of the work that was done in that time frame by ILM and by other vendors, there's a couple of comps that are like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised that one got such legs because while it was incredibly obvious what had been done, because, you know, you had sort of before and after so obvious to anyone watching it, it felt to me like one of the least successful comps in the film or effect shots in the film. And I wouldn't have been surprised if that had sort of been otherwise buried or at least not highlighted. But let's discuss, first, I mean, obviously, all excuses aside, because it was done, you know, years ago, before digital, et cetera, on such a tight time frame. But notwithstanding that, I mean, why doesn't it work? Because I think one of the useful things is to identify why it doesn't work, even with our modern aesthetic. What's wrong with it?
Well, just looking back at it, there's only a couple layers there. We have the blue screen of Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox, a shot. I think they were standing on a mirror to try and get like pristine reflections, and then you've got your background plate with the actual physical effects of the fire being ignited, and I think overcranked, you know, running faster than normal because there was no way that fire could ignite that fast. So essentially, we have two layers. And then everything from that point on is extraction and then layering and things like that. So a couple of the things that I don't think worked as well as it could have, the lighting on the blue screen I think suffered because it didn't seem like they didn't really plan on where the actual fire trails were going to land between the actors. There's an insert shot that was shot on location, which is the shot that precedes it, of the fire trail going exactly between both of their legs. And in the blue screen, you know, Christopher Lloyd does kind of a sidestep and takes a step. Michael J. Fox basically keeps on his same mark and turns around. But in the comp, the fire is nowhere near right between their legs. Secondly, I don't think they had any interactive light on the actors' feet. So it seems like they're kind of just ambiently lit by, you know, the whatever lighting they had at the time pre-fire. So that's one thing. And then there's some occlusion issues with the reflection. Like, I don't even see the reflection. I see the reflection of the fire that happened in the actual plate. So when you kind of put a, if only one of those things were problematic.
Well, let me add a couple more to that list, but not in the purposes of being nasty to ILM, but just in purposes of like training one's eye. So I don't think that the black levels matched. I think that's a property of doing the opticals that you tended to get sometimes a lack of contrast. And because we're talking optically, you didn't have a contrast button you could control. So I felt like the black levels in the plate suffered. I agree with you totally about the contact lighting, which I've always think is a big one. For me, the other problem is they had Michael J. Fox in blue jeans on a blue Psyche without, you know, the benefit of modern digital rotoring. So if you actually watch the fire, he's seen through his leg. Yeah, his legs are actually transparent. And then I think there's also a problem with eyeline to do with the Doc's eyeline and stuff because I think they could basically pick a take for one of the two of them as opposed to today. We'd address those problems by, A, you'd have a video split, so that would help you line up. B, you'd be able to do a test comp on set, so you'd see that the dock moved. You'd obviously be able to either roto or do the key properly. And you'd give them better eye lines because I guess we're just better at it. But I think the last thing, I mean, you to jump in here, Mark, is if we were doing that shot today, you'd probably do all sorts of moves, camera shakes, other things just to make both elements kind of move together.
Well, I have a question, actually. Did you guys understand that actually none of the shots were approved until a week before?
Yes.
So in other words, at some point, we had a director and producer who hated everything they were seeing.
Yes.
From ILM.
Yes.
Okay. So the thing that actually allows this shot to work such as it does in that, you know, we don't all like toss our popcorn on the floor and leave the theater at this point if we're sitting watching it in 1985, is that the surrounding shots, first of all, are pretty great. Yeah. The shots that lead up to the shot that we're complaining about are actually pretty damn good, including the slightly cheesy and slightly misscaled preceding shot of the flames heading toward them. It's not really right, but it's pretty cool, right? And so there is that thing, I guess, which still holds today, where if you've set it up properly, I don't know, I guess we're talking about what was kind of the money shot. It does kind of not work. And one I'd add is that the fire missed Doc. I don't know if we got that one. It's supposed to go between his legs, and it's like not. It's kind of burning his leg. But, or it should be. But, another thing that occurs to me is I don't know, and I don't think we have an opportunity to do it right now, but I don't know if on the show we've ever really talked about what was involved with opticals with doing these kind of shots. I think some of the listeners probably know, and I think it would be too much of maybe a side trip for us to do it, and I don't feel qualified to give all the ins and outs. What I do know is, you know, they had basically one shot on a lot of these, so one thing that we definitely would do today is probably have more than one take.
Well, yeah, and the other thing is you'd render a shot like this if you were the compositor maybe what 50 times during a session for review personally, to review with your immediate digital supervisor, for review with the show supervisor, and then with the director. It's not like, you know, you could do that many passes through the optical process, even if you had time, yet alone in a situation like that, and they had no time. The only reason I say that is, and I ask for your criticism, is not, as I say, to pick on ILM. I just think that if you are listening to this podcast and you see a shot, I think the worst thing in the world is just to say that shot sucks. I'm happy with someone to say that shot's unsuccessful, but you should be able to articulate why it is unsuccessful or successful and then learn from it. And I think that that's kind of why we do the show. Like, we're not interested in picking on anyone, but we are interested in like why something works or not.
Looking through it with the lens of history and within a context, there's something about, at least for me, I'm able to excuse like crazy dark matte lines and maybe slightly even transparent mattes and things like that, because those were the limitations of the time and equipment at the time. And every single film from that era is going to have those types of issues. So for some reason, I kind of allow those to, you know, be, oh, okay, well, that's part of the vocabulary of a film that was shot in 1985, and that's how it is. It's the only things that I have true criticisms about, like that shot, are like the setup and design issues about having it, you know, having Doc not exactly standing in the right place and the reflections
okay,
and not working.
But let me just say, though, that if you were, because I was always intending on doing this, let's contrast that with the lightning hit that goes down the lines that causes the car to be able to get back from the past at 4 minutes past whenever. So I think that the lightning animation, the hand-drawn animation of electricity as the Doc's trying to put the plugs together and as it comes down the line, I think that holds up really well. I think it's exceptionally
Wes Takahashi did all that stuff frame by frame and just did such an extraordinary job. And you know, electricity and lightning is something that is you'd think, oh, okay, well, you just draw in some lightning, or nowadays you use a lightning plug-in. And boy, you know, getting character into that is not at all easy. And you could go down some crazy roads getting electricity to look right and to have either some character or no character. And yeah, there were some
It's hard. I mean, I've had the job of trying to – somebody's, you know, had a commercial and they said, can you emulate that thing? And we want it to zap around their head, and they were like, I'm meant to be a robot or something. And we want a little zap on their teeth at the end because we think that'll be funny. And I thought, yeah, you know, it'll take me a couple of hours. Oh, my Lord. It's just so hard to do.
I actually had the opportunity on episode 3. We were doing some early tests on Force Lightning with the Emperor – you know, hitting Yoda and all that stuff, and some stuff with one of the not TIE fighters getting hit and in a space battle. And John Knoll specifically referenced some Empire Strikes Back shots where there was lightning or electricity going around a TIE fighter that got hit in the asteroid chase. As well as, obviously, we know what the Force Lightning is supposed to look like. So I took it upon myself to shun all plugins and actually try to draw it frame by frame using Commotion at the time. And boy, you know, that is some hard stuff. The good news is that some of it actually made it into the movie. Some of the early Yoda stuff is my hand-drawn stuff. But I tried to talk to anybody at the company that was still there that actually did hand-drawn electricity, and I got some tips. But boy, it is just really hard to get character into this stuff.
Have you ever done this, Mark? Drawn lightning kind of zappy stuff?
I've tried. I also remember working with a couple of guys who were these types of old school effects animators. One of whom, right after I worked with him, ended up on, I think, Fantasia 2000, which was going to be like a 5-year gig of just animating smoke. And he was brilliant at it. And it's honest-to-God animation. It's it's a different beast than, say, Jessica Rabbit or something else you could think of from this era. But it's, the reason that we've hit the wall in small attempts at it is that it takes a lot of experience and effort. And I would even say there's probably some of Wes Takahashi's personality in this lightning.
If you were like somebody comes along today and they approach the three of us and they said, oh, guys, we want to do a Pepsi commercial to mimic the, you know, Back to the Future stuff, I would be seriously flagging that as, okay, we need quite a bit of time to get that to work properly. Because even the plug-in stuff, getting that to perform, sure, putting a bolt of lightning between two points, a good plug-in will do that. But that sort of character, as you say, that he got into that. And also a believability that it's because there's quite a lot of screen time for something that should be over in like, you know, a 50th of a second. There's a lot of screen time of that stuff zapping. And then they have these little post zaps, like little when it's playing out.
Particularly this shot after the DeLorean already went back to the future, and you're just looking at the wire bouncing up and down at the clock attached to the clock tower, and there's still some residual zapping going on. It's like, oh my God, that's just so good.
That is so gorgeous, and it's so easy just, I think, to not give that credit. So the reason I mention that is I think that while we maybe criticized, I don't think we've done, we've given praise to this work, which I think was exceptional. Let me ask you, what did you think, in the same vein of like looking at the specific visual effect shots, of the nature of the end shot? Because as a kid, I was air punching the sky when that car turned and took off. But I mean, I got to say, for judging visual effects work, well, I'm preempting you guys, but I think the miniatures work of ILM from this period delivered such resoundingly strong results that 25 years on as we are today, it's still remarkably better than it should be for being 25 years later.
Yeah, you know, it's too bad that there is no model shop at ILM anymore, because that used to be the coolest place to go. I mean, that car was hanging up, you know, by the ceiling along with 100 other icons of movies, but this was definitely one of the best. And I would say that last shot, to be honest, this other stuff holds up so well that it's hard not to say that some of the effects that we were just talking about on the car are some of the best. But I would say that closing shot makes this movie feel like much more of an effects film than it is, because it goes to a whole other level than we've seen either story-wise or effects-wise in the rest of the film. And actually, I'm, you know, watching it, I'm looking at it going, well, how did they hold out the tree? Like, I don't actually know exactly.
Yeah, I know how they hold out that tree. He's actually still at ILM. His roto supervisor, roto artist, Jack Montgolfin, articulated leaves to have it go through that, to have it go behind the tree. And it's like, yeah, rotoring leaves, that's one thing. And then optically, all right, that must have been a fun job.
There are two aspects of that shot that make it one of my all-time favorite shots, apart from the fact that I just, as I say, as a kid, was like just cheering. The first is that the indicator light goes on as it turns at the end, because to me that was some kind of godlike status of attention to detail that meant that ILM, you know, was like, I'm not worthy. I read, of course, later when Cinefix came out or whatever, that there, and I just totally didn't notice it in the cinema, that when the car goes under the trees, there's no shadow cast on the car from the trees. Didn't right. care at the time, you know? I mean,
yeah. You know, you totally excuse it. Once again, in the context of the film, you know, this surprise ending that you weren't at all expecting. And this, you know, first off, Doc comes back to the future. He's wearing this crazy outfit. He's screaming all these things, getting everybody in the car, talking about their kids. And then the car takes off and flies away. I mean, we're all just blown away. I mean, those things just kind of get washed away.
It was a great case of a, almost like an establishing shot, is it's a great case of a heroic kind of visual effects shot that lifted the audience, because it gave you the impossible, and it wasn't obvious, and it wasn't gratuitous. I mean, you really, that elevated the tone of the end of the film. And I think Mark nailed it when you said that shot so burnt into our consciousness that we gave the whole film credit for being more sci-fi than it was.
Well, plus, I got to say, you know, I think we have to mention that anybody who had experienced the film on home video realized that right after that shot, and it, you know, gives you that big flash of the time slice effect, that amazing animated graphic of "to be continued," dot, yes. dot, dot, that was only in the home video version. That was never actually in the original theatrical release of the film. They went straight to the cast credits, the one that was originally released. And Universal, and I'm not even sure with Zemeckis and Bob Gale's permission, it sounds like something that Universal would do behind their back, added the "to be continued" purely for the home video release, because they were going to make a sequel no matter what.
Yeah. I remember really clearly the stunned surprise when they said they were going to do two sequels to this film. I mean, today that doesn't seem like such a big deal, but back then it was just unheard of to not just do a sequel, but to do two sequels. I mean, it was just, and of course there was some criticism of it because of the fact that the second one had such a cliffhanger ending. But one thing I wanted to comment on to do with those sequels, which I thought was hysterical, is when I was rereading the Cinefix article, Ken Ralston, obviously a very, very good visual effects supervisor, but he's joking that end car was a particularly highly articulated model that was going to appear in a number of shots only ended up appearing in one, and the writer or somebody sort of obviously indicated, well, what a shame that was only used in the one shot. And he jokes, well, if they ever do a sequel to this film, at least they're going to have a really good car model for the next film. And he wrote this, or this was written, obviously before there was any redefining of popular culture by the film that necessitated the sequels. Ironically, when they came back to do the sequels, they picked them up, as you know, right after the first one ended. And the first thing they had to do is completely rebuild the model because they wanted in the sequel to see into the car as it flew off, and they had a side shot for the time slice effect. And so as a consequence, the model, while still the basis of what's used in the second film for the matching shot, was in fact almost completely rebuilt. So I think this just goes to this whole idea of reusing assets. I mean, if you can have a beautifully precision engineered, I think it was, what, 1/5 scale model of a DeLorean for
that's
a film
right.
like this by ILM that's only used in one shot, that is perfectly ready for the next shot that comes along, which will happen moments later, and you still have to rework the asset completely, what hope does that give us for any asset in any film?
Well, having worked on a couple Transformers films, I'll tell you the one thing, that the adage is still the same, no matter how good you think you build something, and then you're like, hey, we can just use it for the sequel. That's not really the case. You're going to get a lot closer, and you're going to do things with that model that you never, ever expected when you originally built it.
I was talking to to one of the guys from Pixar our FX podcast, and Michael was saying that when they brought Jesse in to the second Toy Story film, the problem wasn't that the model was fundamentally different in its characteristics or anything else from Woody. It's just it looked so much better because it was a whole sort of different generation of technology that produced it, that even though Woody was in every respect, on paper matching, he just looked cruddy in comparison. The seams, the quality of the cloth work, the denim. And again, when they got to the third film, every time they sort of redid those films, even though they shouldn't have changed between, and they're fully digital assets, they're like, oh no, now we're going to redo it again. Hey, let's go back to the aging stuff, because this is one of the things I think is worth discussing. It's one of, if not the hardest kind of special effects makeup tricks. You can blow someone's head apart, you can put squibs on their chest, you can do all sorts of things, you can stick aliens in their chest, but getting somebody to age successfully and still have a performance that works is, from the special effects guys I've spoken to, just really, really hard. We were doing a short film with the MEG guys that were responsible for a lot of stuff in the first Matrix film and a bunch of really great films, A-grade guys, and I was saying, well, we think we're doing this zombie or old age. They're like, oh, forget the old age stuff. It's so freaking hard. We'll do as many zombies as you like. Just don't make us do age makeup. So what did you think of the aging makeup in this? And after that, we might move on to discussing how you do it today. Mark, what did you think of the character's ability to be looking actually aged in this first film?
I think I bought it. I was pretty young when I saw the film, so I would have... I'm trying to remember if I was totally fooled by Leah Thompson or if I kind of knew. I don't remember, but...
I remember being fooled by her. I think the only character that bothered me was Biff. His car waxing makeup really and I don't know. So do you think that was a performance thing, or do you think that was a makeup thing?
I think it's purely a performance thing. I mean, we had the same – for one thing, there were two huge challenges with the old age makeup of this film. Not only were the characters aging about like 30 years rather than, say, 50 years, these weren't old, decrepit, elderly people that we were talking about. We're talking about what they were 17 in the 50s and 47. So 47 years old for a young actor who's, in their early 20s, how do you pull that off? I think Leah Thompson and Crispin Glover, their performances were relatively subdued in both versions of their old selves, because then they not only had to act a certain way as old the old characters in the one reality of 1985, but then the second reality, their performances by their very nature were relatively understated. They weren't trying to be all flashy and to do all these things, but by Biff's nature, Thomas F. Wilson's nature, both of those old Biffs were going to be, a little bit over the top. And I think that helped, you know, lose, it lost a little bit of its credibility there. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that there was really nowhere to hide with these dialogue sequences with these folks in their old age makeup. These were long shots. These were long Robert Zemeckis shots, long exposition, and, you know, relatively wide. They never really went in for a super tight close-up, but still, there was just nowhere to hide. It's not like it was a little cameo or a little, you know, a one-off shot. These were full-on scenes.
Yeah, anything I'd say is, and I think I, by way of comparison, I don't want to do the sequels too much, but I felt differently in the second film when they had the aging makeup on all the characters. Firstly, I did think the Biff makeup on the very older Biff, the one that sort of reinforces what you were saying, Todd, because he sold it more easily being the older, cynical Biff that goes back and steals the DeLorean. But I also felt like by then we also had a big problem that it became incredibly Zemeckis indulgent with the split screen stuff. Now, I'm really in awe of the technology for the multiple pass stuff that they did with the, was it Vista Glide? Vista something.
No, you were right, yeah.
Vista Glide. Yeah, but I just felt that some of those shots in the future, you know, with the rehydrating the pizza stuff, where you had Michael J. Fox playing women and playing himself and playing a younger version of whatever, that all just got so self-indulgent that I just was not so engaged in the film anymore.
Well, I'm really glad that you actually brought up the term indulgent, because this, like Back to the Future, there is barely a shred of fat on this film. It is one of the most efficient films, not only from a visual effects standpoint, but every single line of that movie is basically either a setup or a payoff. The payoff might be, you know, 30, 40 minutes after the setup was actually created, but there's very little indulgence in the film. And, you know, like we said, that doing old age makeup on an 80-year-old is a lot relatively easier than on a 50-year-old.
I guess the only thing I was going to say is that it's stunning to me that while I felt that it was indulgent in the second sequel, the third film, which was made obviously immediately after the second one as this 1-2 or the 2-3 punch, didn't feel that way at all. It really felt terrific. It was bizarre that the second film had all the hallmarks of the dip that you get in a trilogy sometimes, where the second film tries to sort of do too much and gets too convoluted. And the third one just played out, I thought, really, really well. I really enjoyed the third one, the Western. I enjoyed it much more than I enjoyed some of the second one. I thought some parts of the second one were terrific, but a lot of the breast augmentation stuff in the alternate 1985 with the shots of the casino, the Biffdom or whatever it was, Biff World, and that stuff in the future with the family and the rehydrating the pizza, just didn't seem to be as tight, didn't seem to be as plot-driven. It was a bit more indulgent. The first one, of course, I just thought was near perfect. I'm just wondering if you guys felt the same way. Was the second film one that you didn't really get into? And did you feel that my criticism is valid there?
Well, we're talking about the movie now. But if we're going to talk about visual effects, I think we got to give some props to the second one. First of all, it was daring enough to drive the car around in the future, which I thought was pretty stunning. Like, we got to see futuristic freeways and exit ramps and stuff. And if you remember back to that time, there weren't a lot of future movies. I mean, there was Blade Runner, but you didn't, and that was a lot earlier. But end of the 80s, early 90s, there just weren't a lot of productions that were that brave about doing a visualization like that.
That sequence that you're talking about from when they go into the future, the town square, the Jaws 19 and all that town square stuff, I agree with you. That was, from a visual effects point of view.
Well, and the hoverboards. The hoverboards are really cool.
Effects, right? Really good. I just felt, and in terms of the third film, nearly all the visual effects, of course, are stacked at the very, very, very end of the third film with the train sequence. Both
well,
the train
by design,
sequence.
The second film was kind of meant to be a frenetic, playful action picture. And then the third film was by design supposed to be a little bit slower rhythm, a little bit more contemplative. And on those, you know, if that indeed was the design, you know, they absolutely nailed it.
But I don't think the visual effects, in the scene that you were referring to, Mark, you know, the town, mm-hmm. totally worked totally supported the story and really moved stuff along, and I felt terrific. The 80s cafe to the all that sequence, loved it. I just felt it got in the way. Like the visual effects really kind of bogged the film down in the future with all of this split screen stuff. It just felt very restricted. The camera moves felt like they were, you know, motion control because they had to be sort of replayed, so they weren't, I don't know, it just felt somehow constrained. Well,
you know, through looking at it now, I mean, there's still so many, how did they do that moments in Back to the Future 2? One in particular is when the DeLorean, they feel like they fixed things in the future, Doc and Marty, and they zap back to 1985. They don't realize it, but they're in the alternate 1985. The camera is looking at the DeLorean still kind of cruising, coming down for a landing. And you're like, oh, you know, intellectually, you're thinking, oh, it's just a model shot. The shot continues, and almost right in front of your eyes, it lands on the ground, the doors open, and the actors get out. And you're like, wait a second, when did they do the changeover? And you're just sitting there go, how did they do that? Well, it only takes one more viewing to realize that they hit a split between a lamppost and in the front of a lamppost. But when you're watching it within the context of the movie, the shot design just so blew me away. And there's so many of those with all the split screens. When old Biff hands the almanac to young Biff, his hand was actually a motion control rod. It wasn't even the actor's arm, and because it had to do the exact same move and both passes. I mean, there's some brilliant stuff in there.
All right. Well, I stand corrected. I think you're probably right, and I'm wrong. So let me swing you back, though, to the special effects makeup. The modern equivalent of this is, of course, to do digital stuff, as we saw probably best, I think, in X-Men, the anti-aging stuff then. Would that be, I guess, for you, Todd, would that be the best anti-aging stuff you've seen digitally?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of anything offhand that really blew me away. I mean, the X-Men... That was the beginning of X-Men 2, is that right, with Ian McKellen? And
it might have been X-Men 3, yeah.
Yeah. I got to give it up for Benjamin Button, though.
Mark, I tried to give you that one. Benjamin Button, I'm idiotically, stupidly embarrassed to have missed that. That obviously is probably the gold standard for anti-aging. You're absolutely right.
Oh, well, for once I wasn't the one to totally forget something.
No, that would be me, yeah. I think that is, without a doubt, I completely spaced on that. But it is fully digital, of course, and I wonder whether we just now move old aging stuff to the, you know, unless it's a wide shot, it's just not worth the effort because we can't get the performance good enough. Or is it still that Benjamin Button was so hard to do that you'd do it with makeup? If you were given the script, I mean... How quickly do you move to digital today?
Well, no, it's not. I mean, the type of project would have to be such that the role of whatever actor that needs to go through extreme aging is so integral to the story and so important to the story that a studio and an effects house would have to still, even at this point, make a significant investment in time and R&D and testing and all this stuff. I mean, even if you wanted to make a Benjamin Button 2 right now, I mean, even with the Brad Pitt work already done, it still would be such an enormous undertaking, and that can only be used for Brad Pitt. Any other actor is, at this point, still kind of a ground-up R&D undertaking. So... You know, it really depends on the project. I mean, when it comes to doing old age makeup, I mean, there's still some, you know, there's still some artists out there that are doing amazing work. Like, I'm thinking of, I don't know if you guys saw The Hours. Julianne mm-hmm. Moore had to do a significant portion of the ending in an old age makeup. And I got to say, it was not over the top. And it was, you know, because old age makeup is an additive process. I mean, you can't take away anything from an actor's face. And sometimes we, you know, like, especially with, like, we were talking about the Biff stuff, the prosthetics and the appliances just overwhelm the actor's face. Whereas in that particular case, the Julianne Moore in The Hours case, I thought it was really well done and totally convincing. So, you know, it really depends on the project. And even at this point, I mean, we're going to obviously get to a point where we're barely even thinking about, you know, doing an old age, digital old age makeup on somebody. But at this point, it's still a significant investment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, I think for 34 or 32 shots, we've had a good time talking about this film, and I'd applaud people that haven't seen it in a while. Just go back and see it again. It's worth it. It's not without its faults, and obviously it's not without its aging. Certain aspects of this film don't hold up, but on the whole, I think it holds up pretty darn well. And I must admit, I've really enjoyed talking to you guys today. I just got to mention, Todd, one thing, though. I've got you on the line. I feel ridiculous doing this, but I've got to tell you, one of, you know, you're talking about, I think you or Mark said something about wanting to get into films because you saw Back to the Future and that was significant. I'm going to ask you about an earlier website that you did that had a big influence on me when we were setting up FX Guide, which was the VFX HQ.
Yeah, I remember doing that. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I still use it on a regular basis as a resource. In fact, just before we got on here, I looked at the Academy Awards section to see what other films had been nominated that year. It was Cocoon won the Oscar in 1985, Return to Oz, and Young Sherlock Holmes were the other nominees.
Well, I didn't know you back then, obviously, as we established at the beginning of the show, but I remember being incredibly happy when you decided to stop doing it while simultaneously being miserable. One, because you were so good at it that I thought, well, at least we stand some chance with FX Guide of picking up some of the slack. And secondly, so disappointed because I think I, amongst many other people, just found it such a great resource. It must have been, what, very taxing on your time? Is that why you stopped doing it? Because back in the day, it was the place to go.
At the time, before I entered the industry, I was just such a big fan and of visual effects, and I had like my own like internal list of what houses were working on, what was Digital Domain working on, what was ILM working on, and I was like, wow, you know, I think people online would like to, maybe I'd like to share this with people. So that's kind of how it started, and then I was like, you know, I love Cinefex magazine. It was my primary, you know, education source for learning about visual effects. But they never get into the editorial type content of actually subjectively saying, you know, what worked about a shot, what didn't work about the shot, and not just saying the effects in this movie sucked. You know, getting a little bit deeper into, you know, what didn't work. Was it a design a problem? Was it an execution problem? So I felt like there was a vacuum there, and I did all I can to try and fill it.
On behalf of all the effects sites that came after you, including FX Guide, which started obviously as you were finishing up in the 90s, and we were obviously starting in the 90s. I got to owe you a debt of gratitude because really it was a landmark website, and it's just a mark of how old the web is now that we can actually look back on something like that and point out how significant it was. But as an industry, you were contributing back then, which is extraordinary, really.
You're very kind. Thanks very much. Yeah, you know, it's every once in a while on a particularly tough day when I'm really happy with my shot and my shot doesn't final, I'm like, oh God, it'd be so nice to just write about visual effects movies and not have to work on these things. But no, I only on the worst days do I actually miss those days. I mean, I really miss getting to see all the visual effects movies and get to talk to all the visual effects folks. But I also don't miss seeing all the terrible visual effects movies because there are just so many. I'm not talking about the effects. I'm talking about the actual films. There's just so many that I had to sit through. Oh God. I'm thinking of Daylight right now. Is that Stallone movie? Oh boy. Anyway.
Stallone effects films. Though having said that, there was some really nice early tracking I remember in Cliffhanger. I still was in awe of how they did some of the tracking back in that. But apart from that, yes, Stallone effects films.
Love Cliffhanger. Oh, you're very kind.
So, Mark, I should actually finish that out by saying that site is long dead, or rather long inactive, but still maintained for historical value. So check it out by all means. But as we said at the top of the show, if somebody wants to go to your site now, where should they go?
They can go there. They can go to vfxhq.com, or I write random stuff on a semi-regular basis at fxrant.blogspot.com. Don't get your hopes up about that site.
I know you are very, very busy, and we appreciate you taking time to talk to us. And Mark, what about you?
Yeah, I'm going to give Flow Seeker on Twitter as the place to find me. I may have to change that handle because I think it was Matt Wallen today who addressed me as Flower Seek on there. Yeah. So I'm rethinking.
You but, hippie?
For now, that's where I am.
Are either of you going to Sidgrove?
Unfortunately, no. My workload is just a bit too big right now.
Yeah, I will not make it either. Alas, Mike, you're going to have to...
Well, I head off this weekend to Yellowstone, where we're filming for FXPHD for a week, and then to Los Angeles on the 26th, obviously, for Sidgraph, because for me, I'm in the luxurious position of having that as such an important event in our planning life that I wouldn't miss it anymore. But I completely appreciate
how hard it would be. For those on the fence, it is the most inspiring show, for sure.
And LA is such a good place to have it. And we actually have a really good story coming up on FX Guide listing it was kind of a bit self-indulgent of myself, so criticizing myself, but I really was looking at all the papers a while ago, and I'm sure you guys can appreciate this. I thought, which paper should I go and see? And then I realized that at FX Guide, we have such a great audience of people and people that we know from doing it for so many years now. So I contacted some really top people like Dana at Pixar and Paul DeBevic and people, the head of R&D at Weta and Sony. And we just got these guys to name the papers that they wanted to go and see. So I can simply have a tally of who these people that I respected, what papers they were seeing. And then I figured, well, I just followed them. I just go to whatever they said. That would make me look good. And I wouldn't miss out on the good stuff. So that's actually coming out by the time I think you hear this, or very soon on this weekend on FX Guide. And of course, a new term has just started over at fxphd.com. So if you're into visual effects and want to do training, our site at fxphd.com is a good place to go. Where, in fact, Mark has been teaching for us now for some time. Mark, when did you first join our...
I think it was it the second term or the third?
Very early on, we begged Mark to help us, and he's been very kind in doing it. Thank you guys so much for listening to the show. We really do appreciate your support. I'm going to ask you one final thing, if I can, if I've still got your attention, which is that there is a survey we've put up over at FX Guide. It's at fxguide.com/survey. We're spending a lot of time and effort right now improving FX Guide, and we really need some information on who you are. And already we've learned an enormous amount. I think astonishing percentage, like 97% of you are actually in the industry that listen to this. So if you could fill out that demographic thing to give us a bit of better of a profile of which areas of the profession you're in and where you're at and stuff, we'd really appreciate it. We get hundreds of thousands of hits, obviously, a week and per month, but we do want to know a bit more about you if we could. I only can offer you that there's a prize of an iPad if you manage to fill that out this week. But personally, if I could just ask you to do it as a favor, we'd really appreciate it. Well, that's it for this week. We'll be back probably in 2 weeks' time. We have a bunch of really good shows coming up as we finish up the US summer. I want to thank you, Todd, and thank you, Mark, for being with us. It's been a great, great show, and I've really enjoyed it, and I hope we can get you both back.
Mike, let's not forget to thank our producers for their gigawatts of energy.
You're absolutely right. And we just couldn't do the show without them. They're both brilliant. We're, of course, referring to Matt and to... Mark, you started. Why don't you thank the guys?
Give it up for Matt Graham and Todd Skolton, our producers, who make it happen.
So Matt does, in addition to producing, a lot of the editing, and Todd introducing... producing does a lot of the research and stuff, and we really rely on these guys, and they are as is in fact all the people that are on the FX show volunteers. We really appreciate everyone's time, and we thank you guys for listening. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See ya.